This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Even if they have like brick masonry with mud, there's very, very minimum what we call shear value, shear resistance in those kind of like structures against like, a seismic load or any other like lateral load.
That was Bashir Ahmed of Structural Consulting Engineers on how the mud and brick structures in Morocco's mountains were no match for a 6.8 earthquake. Details coming up. Also, the Food and Agriculture Organization is launching a plan to help at least 10 million Sudanese. And gaining membership in the G20 is a powerful acknowledgement of Africa as it seeks a greater role on the global stage. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Devastating floods from the Mediterranean storm Danielle engulfed several cities in eastern Libya, killing more than 2,000 people, with thousands more still missing. Rescue workers face challenges due to severed communication lines and power outages. For more, VOA's Hassuna Bayishu spoke to Rami Musa, a humanitarian worker based in Benghazi, who said the death toll could hit 5,000.
There has been official warning from the government over the past week on reports on weather forecast and so on, that there would be a storm hitting the eastern part of Libya. But the eye of the storm was expected to hit the city of Benghazi and the neighboring city, but somehow the storm drifted away directly towards Derna, and the geographical area of Derna is mostly it's kind of divided into two parts. There's both on a mountain top, and there's a valley that divides the city into half, and that's where the flood took place, because of the dams had not been reconstructed or had no maintenance for about maybe 10 more years, and the flooding, the amount of rain is has never the whole of the country never seen such an amount.
Have the surrounding areas been evacuated already?
Yes, but the issue is that most of the roads and the streets have collapsed, and there's no very little. There's no electricity. There's no telecommunication. So it's very difficult to grasp the situation and how many people are missing. Some over say over 10,000, perhaps even more. But the issue is that some families were wiped out, so with nobody to report who is missing and who's not. So it's still very early to grasp how disastrous the situation is. But from what we're seeing now, this has been a huge hit to Libya in terms of historical disastrous situation.
What are the immediate relief efforts being deployed to assess the affected community in Libya? I know that a couple of international and local organizations are trying to help out, but are you aware of any sort of coordination between these organizations and the government?
There have been appeals from the government to neighboring countries, and many neighboring countries have answer to the call. But the issue is that it's very difficult to spread out over this massive area, especially that it's not just Derna. Even the neighboring towns and cities are being surrounded by water. We don't know what the situation is in these areas, especially the cities at the foot of the Green Mountain. And it's still, like I said, the whole picture is not clear yet. And we will find out in the next perhaps 24 or 48 hours. In terms of international relief and support, it's still not being there's no effective mechanism or tools to deploy these assistance effectively, and the government has been paralyzed, and now they're trying to cope and trying to take control of the situation. But the military has been involved heavily, and perhaps the Egyptian army will send as well some assistance.
That was Rami Musa, a humanitarian worker based in Benghazi, speaking with VOA's Hassuna Baishu about Libya's deadly flooding. In Morocco, the death toll from Friday's earthquake has climbed to more than 2,900, with another 5,500 injured. The quake flattened fragile mud and brick houses, leaving hundreds of residents homeless in small villages across the high Atlas Mountains. Moroccan authorities have tried in recent years to improve earthquake resilience, including passing tougher building codes, but many villagers still live in the same structures. Bashir Ahmadi, a structural engineer with Structure Consulting Engineers of Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., says there is a reason brick and mud homes like the ones in Morocco's high Atlas Mountains are not built in the U.S.
Plain brick masonry is not allowed in the U.S., especially in high seismic regions. But in Morocco, I would say, I don't know the specifics of the Moroccan building code, but I would say that is not a building system that would have like real good resistance to seismic load. And they are susceptible to that kind of damage. A lot of times in the developing world, most of these countries don't have a proper building code with actual research and then, you know, compatible with their geography and then the seismicity of that land and the areas. But more than that, from what I've been reading, is that although some of the countries, like in Turkey has a really good building code and really like in-depth seismic code, but the construction is a problem, is that a lot of these buildings aren't done per the code, and there's not much inspection and execution through the government to make sure that the buildings are built per the building code, and then all the seismic requirements are followed.
I imagine when you're talking about in a place like this, where we've seen these little small homes that are built like right on top of each other on these higher elevations, they're made out of mud and brick. So I don't really think that they're following some kind of permitting process up there. They build what they can, right?
I would assume so. Yeah, I would assume so. And like, I mean, this is mud. Even if they have like brick masonry with mud, there's very, very minimum what we call shear resistance in those kind of like structures against like a seismic load or any other like lateral load. So yes, I agree. I don't think there's a proper permitting process. If there was, that would be crazy from a government authority to permit such structures. But you're right. It's mainly that they were not permitted. If they were, it's just that the execution, the inspection by the governing authorities, that's what's lacking in those countries, I think.
You've done your research on earthquakes, I understand, for your degree. What do you recommend, or what do structural engineers think should happen in countries like this where, it's poverty-stricken areas, it's mountainous areas where these people live in these villages? What can be done moving forward when they try to rebuild?
It would be very expensive to rebuild these structures and these homes per internationally renowned like standards, like in the US or Europe. Probably there's lack of material and there's lack of resources In my opinion, the best and efficient approach would be that somehow some sort of international funding should be allocated where research should be done locally to see what kind of material we have available, and then using those kind of material, building seismic resistant systems within these buildings. That's kind of more practical.
That's Bashir Ahmadi, a structural engineer with Structure Consulting Engineers. He was speaking to VAO's Carol Van Dam from Alexandria, Virginia. Dozens of countries, including the United States, have offered assistance to Morocco, but the government has limited access to some foreign medical and technical teams. Moroccan businessman Charles Dahan, who lives in Maryland, left Marrakesh the night before the earthquake hit. He tells Carol Van Dam he vividly remembers the last quake in his home country more than six decades ago.
We survived an earthquake in the 60s, in 1960 actually, in February 29, 1960, where the city of Agadir was totally destroyed. The number of deaths at that time was in the 20,000, which was ridiculous. And so we grew up with earthquake tremors all our life. So we know Morocco was on a big fault, and we used to sleep outdoors as soon as we would feel some tremors. I remember telling us that when you see the dogs going crazy and the birds flying around like crazy, you know that something is coming. I happened to be in Marrakesh. I left Marrakesh on Thursday, and I found out that the earthquake happened on Friday night. As soon as I found out, I could not find any news until Saturday. I called the hotel where I stayed for the last 2 weeks, and they were telling me that most of the guests were sleeping around the pool on mattresses.
Your family is very familiar with that area. You say you used to grow trees there?
My association, which is called the High Atlas Foundation, we've been planting trees for the last 20 years in this High Atlas Mountain. And we know the villages, we know the people, we know their wives, we know the children. We've been planting a million trees a year, fruit trees, to help them combat poverty. This village are very, very poor. People live in mud house, you know, nothing structural. The only thing that usually structural in this area is the mosque.
With this foundation that you're doing, are you trying to raise funds especially for this?
We have the infrastructure to send trucks, and send the trucks that we use to bring trees, and all that logistic is there. So they've been asking us to send them like sleeping bags and covers to sleep outdoors at night. We had an immediate need for a couple hundred thousand dollars just to provide the minimum to them for a few days. They have absolutely no food. We still have not reached every single douar, which is a small area, smaller than the village, like a few hundred or even a few dozen. And most of these villages have been destroyed at 90%. There is nothing standing there.
That's Moroccan businessman Charles Dahan. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Potomac, Maryland. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, has launched a plan to assist at least 10 million Sudanese farmers, herders, and fishermen. The plan aims to address the threat of food insecurity in the country, which has been exacerbated by a five-month-old armed conflict. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The Food and Agriculture Organization's 12-month program aims to improve the livelihoods of Sudanese farmers, herders and fisher communities impacted by the ongoing war. The FAO will add to recent seed distribution efforts to enhance food production, with the hope of feeding 13 to 19 million people in coming months. Abdul Hakim El-Wair is the FAO regional representative for the Near East and North Africa. He says that the Emergency Livelihood Response Plan is designed to combat hunger and poverty in Sudan.
The ELRP aims to mitigate the impact of the recent conflict on vulnerable people, address their immediate needs, and enhance their ability to recover and strengthen their resilience, besides achieving food security at its minimum level for the overall population. Agriculture remains a lifeline in Sudan.
Sudan plunged into conflict in April, sparked by a power struggle between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces. The conflict has killed thousands of people, displaced millions, and prompted millions more to seek refuge in neighboring countries in search of food, medicine, and shelter. The FAO program intends to support farmers, herders, and fishers across 17 states in the country. Mohamed Abdulrahman, a farmer in Sudan's Upper Nile state, expressed optimism about the assistance.
I think this will help and will help us and will make others be encouraged to look and run after such kind of help and organize themselves in the first place. But I think the condition is demanding, is needed seriously. The Sudanese people need help from the international community, because really they lose their government.
Aid agencies say during Sudan's dry season, which runs from November to May, farmers reliant on rainfall face food shortages, while livestock owners are faced with water and pasta shortages. Leading to threatened livelihoods. According to the Integrated Food Security Phase projections published last month, more than 20.3 million Sudanese are food insecure, with 6 million suffering from emergency levels of acute hunger. Abdulrahman says that Sudanese farmers require more than just seeds to produce food.
But I don't think that's enough, because the farmers need more than the seeds. They need money to make the preparations. They need money to go on the other agricultural activities.
The FAO said that much of the support for the vulnerable farming and herding households will be delivered through cash assistance and livelihood input packages, including seeds and agricultural, animal and fishing tools. El-Wair says the successful execution of their plan could prevent a humanitarian crisis and famine in Sudan.
FAO does not supply food directly to individuals, but supplies seeds and agricultural inputs to farmers who are actually food producers to thousands of people. So if we reach out to 1.5 million farmers in Sudan in 14 states, we are literally providing food supplies, mainly vegetables and fruits and seeds, like corn and wheat, for the large population of Sudan by the next harvest season, which will mitigate the situation and the crisis to a large extent.
The agricultural agency said it needs $123 million to achieve its goals, with the program expected to end in August 2024. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
As the military and the paramilitary rapid support forces battle for control of Sudan, indiscriminate shelling and air attacks have become common, reducing the greater Khartoum area and other parts of the country to battlegrounds. The conflict has displaced nearly 5.1 million people within Sudan and across the country's borders. Sama Salaman is a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that Sudan's fighting is one of the worst human rights catastrophes in the world.
The situation in Sudan is absolutely out of hand, and it is one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in the world right now. That doesn't mean that there's no solution possible. Of course there's a solution possible, but it requires political will and it requires adequate and sufficient pressure from the international community.
Talking of political will, the two leaders lately seem not to be eager to speak to each other to end this conflict. Is there anything the international community can do to find a solution?
Well, Douglas, the two generals, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who is the commander of the Sudanese Armed Forces, and the de facto head of the Sovereign Council of Sudan, and his rival, General Hemeti, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who's the commander of the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary, neither one of them has been genuine or really wanted to find a solution to this war from day one. They're in a war to fight for political power, for economic power, and to escape accountability from possible persecution for current war crimes and past war crimes, including, you know, the 2003-2005 Darfur genocide. So neither of them actually wants to find a solution to this war. The solution has to come from extreme pressure from the neighboring countries and the international community, unfortunately. And there are certain tools that can be used to put that pressure on.
How would you describe the impact to the citizens of the country, given that now there's a lack of medical facilities and some people are maybe running out of food soon, according to UN agencies?
Well, I mean, just today, Volker Turk, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva, issued a statement on Sudan at the 54th session of the Human Rights Council. And I can quote you, he said, "This Friday, Sudan will mark 5 months of futility, 5 months of futile suffering, death, loss, and destruction. More than 5 million Sudanese people have been internally displaced. Almost 1 million Sudanese have fled Sudan to neighboring countries. So the Sudanese people are dying from bullets, from bombings, from drone attacks. They're dying from hunger. They're dying from lack of medical attention. They're dying for all sorts of reasons. They're even dying from shock and trauma and from the sight of seeing family members being raped and being shot and their homes being looted and burned. And so there are direct ways that you can be a victim of the Sudanese war, and there are very indirect ways that you can be a victim of the Sudanese war. But the catastrophe is getting worse every single day. There is a famine looming over Sudan. The next agricultural harvest is expected to be extremely low. And so you'll have a huge shortage of domestic agricultural output in Sudan. You have Port Sudan being blocked by the various military factions, and the government in and of itself is placing all sorts of obstacles around the clearance and entry of humanitarian aid. So you have a situation where Sudanese inside Sudan are actually being hijacked in their own country. It's an extremely, extremely dire and desperate situation. And unfortunately, I mean, the world's attention was with Sudan, it seemed, at the beginning of the conflict. But as the conflict has kept on going, there seems to be a wearying or fatigue. Until very recently, when the United States announced targeted sanctions against senior officials of the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, basically saying that they are seeing the same signs of genocide that they saw 20 years ago in Darfur that caused the ICC to indict former President General and dictator Omar al-Bashir and his some of his close inner circle of NCP party officials. And so it is that basically that threat of a repetition of the Darfur genocide that is bringing the world's attention back to Sudan today, right now, as we speak.
That was Sama Salaman, a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She spoke with Douglas Mpuga from Virginia, USA. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.